Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Brian Boyles, whose new book is New Orleans from Boom to Blackout, 100 Days in America's Coolest Hotspot, and novelist Barry Gifford, whose new book is The Up-Down. Every city has a group of go-to guys who make things happen in new and unusual ways. Brian Boyles is one of those New Orleanians. A Tulane graduate, he came back to New Orleans in 2007, and now he's the vice president of content for the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. He's also a well-known DJ and the founder of the People Say Project. And now he can add a new credential, author. His new book is New Orleans Boom and Blackout, 100 Days in America's Coolest Hotspot. Well, Brian, welcome to The Reading Life.
It's great to be here, Susan.
Here we are in America's Coolest Hotspot.
That's true.
I love it.
I can feel the heat.
So tell me about these 100 days. Why did you pick these 100 days? Why did you pick this time period?
I think that we could take any 100 days in New Orleans and probably find enough for a 200-page book. But these specific 100 days actually for me started about a year before the Super Bowl, when the city was going through this really, I think, unprecedented run of visitors around big sporting events. We had a Saints playoff game, the New Orleans Bowl, the Sugar Bowl, the BCS Championship, and the Men's Final Four. New Orleans, probably more than at any time since the levee failures, was now in the national spotlight. And for big extravaganzas, big spectacles, seeing that the Super Bowl was coming down the line, I really wanted to take up the logic that this would be New Orleans in the spotlight. This would be New Orleans' time to shine and represent itself as perhaps post-recovery and now into whatever we call this phase we're in right now. And so I really tried to parallel what the efforts of tourism and the city officials were, which is to say, at 100 days out, we're now in lockdown mode. We need to get things in order and be ready because the whole world's coming to see us.
And if they're not coming, they'll watch us on television.
Exactly.
Now, you've chosen some key events here in government and public life that illustrate that tension between ordinary New Orleanians and the city's drive to brand itself in a new way. The taxicab motorcade, the opening of streetcar line, the difference between the way insiders experience the Super Bowl and other folks. So talk about that kind of tension you found as you traveled the city.
I think all of us have been asked, how's New Orleans doing and what's it really like there? And I think all of us have watched New Orleans on 60 Minutes and seen it portrayed in a million different ways. And I think it'd be hard to argue to think this city's probably been on camera more than any other city in the last 10 years, just consistently.
Well, we're so photogenic.
We really are. And sometimes I think it's not that we've really changed, but that America likes us more than ever. And mm-hmm. That's an interesting dynamic as well. But it's always been interesting to me. And I think at the time that I began the book, the People Say Project was really looking at this idea of money and culture and how the artists and the organizations and filmmakers and service workers were getting by within this much larger, magnified entertainment scene that we have in New Orleans now. I think there's a tension in what the outside world sees, and that will always be there. But there's also a tension on those folks who are really on the ground level doing that work and their understanding of how much the city has changed or how much it hasn't changed and the way those changes impact these people. When it came to some of these things, when we have more and more people coming, it's going to have more and more of an impact on the people living here. And the tension is always going to be, will it continue to be livable for those folks as more and more people are in your backyard and walking on your streets, and the city government serve both the citizens and the people that are coming in, because that generates revenue as well. There's always going to be a tension there between what it's like to live here and what it's like to visit here. What's been interesting, I think, in the last few years is that those efforts to draw people to actually visit here have also been used to draw people to live here as well. So that's become right. more and more the image of New Orleans, and more of the New Orleans way of life is being shaped by these big events, these festivals. It's not just a nuisance. It's not just something we drive around. It's something that's infecting our economy. It's something that's affecting the way people work and the way they live their lives. And I think that tension's interesting because New Orleanians are conscious of their city's image. I think that's an inheritance from the storm, but I think it's probably been that way for 300 years. We mm-hmm. never think anyone quite gets it right. And I think that argument is ongoing. And I kind of wanted to codify that by looking at this narrow space and saying, well, within 100 days, what was
going on?
Yeah, what was right and what wasn't?
Well, you could substitute Hollywood South for the Super Bowl. Almost.
Sure enough.
Yeah, in some ways. Now, I wish you'd tell us about some of the ordinary New Orleanians you talked to. There was one street vendor that was particularly memorable.
There is a section about the French Quarter, because I really mm-hmm. believe the French Quarter is endlessly fascinating, and the people that work there know more about this city and how it operates and who comes to visit here than any of us. There was a really wise guy who reads tarots down there that had real insights from sitting in Jackson Square. You can imagine if you were to sit in Jackson Square and you weren't working, how much insight you would glean onto the city's image, the way it's changed, the attempts to change. But if you were actually talking to people all the time, even more insight is gained. In that case, you know, that's a profession that's been attempted to be regulated many times. They're often sort of vulnerable to new efforts to clean up the quarter, new dangers in the quarter, new events in the quarter. Yeah. And it's that person's perspective that I think we don't get enough of sometimes. We don't see that people have stood and fought to continue a certain way of life for quite a long time within the whirlwind of extravaganzas that are going on. And in his case, could quite eloquently, I think, state both why it's a pain in the butt and also why you stay.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about people like the state trooper on Convention Center Boulevard.
I did kind of go undercover as a volunteer to see how that process worked. But it was interesting to talk to a state trooper because they didn't want to be here.
I know.
The book doesn't even capture, I think, quite how badly they did not want to be here. And they had been housed at a convent. In Jefferson Parish somewhere without television, which they were super angry about. And that's a big cost for the state to send them there. That's
yes.
part of the cost that goes into the Super Bowl. And of course, New Orleans has the best trained crowd control police in the world. And we had all these volunteers, but the state trooper ends up being the one giving the woman from San Francisco directions on where to go. I think that's a case where something in the book has continued to be interesting, in that we now have state troopers coming in and out of the French Quarter to right. make sure that these things work safely. We think of it as far as crime prevention, but in some cases, in this guy's case, it was just the mundane, minute-by-minute cold life outside right. the convention center. And it's always good to hear from the rest of Louisiana about what's up with New Orleans.
That's true. And then the guys in the to-be-continued brass band.
To be a continued brass band, I originally wrote an article about them for Offbeat because I've always believed that brass bands hold such a unique position in understanding the city, and not just as carriers of musical traditions, which is a huge part of what they do, but they are these troubadours who end up street corners to parades to conventions to weddings. They cover the gamut when it comes to New Orleans. And for the most part, they come from disadvantaged backgrounds. They're people that, if they didn't have an instrument in the hand, they would be another very vulnerable member of a population that we continue to see have a hard time making it in New Orleans. But they also glean a certain wisdom from the interactions they have. Now, TBC themselves was most famous for being the band that stood outside the Foot Locker at the front of Bourbon
right.
Street. And those guys were just fascinating because for them, it wasn't so much the money and the tips. It was that they, as musicians and people, really grew standing there and having the world pass by and dance. The other thing that was interesting about them was they were sort of victims of the changes in music policy and in regulations that are going on. Not so much an effort to shut them down as the kind of arbitrary nature of who gets to play live music where. When they started, they were on Bourbon Street, and the police just positioned them in a different place and then positioned them in another place, and then they found themselves at Canal and Bourbon.
Yeah.
And then they found themselves not allowed to play there anymore. And I think that whatever the intentions are there on the side of city government, you have to look at the other side and say, really, what does this do to the livelihood of these guys? These guys who are doing the right thing, who are out there being ambassadors of New Orleans culture and trying to make a buck and staying out of trouble. How do we ensure that we get their viewpoint? And how do we ensure that they get to have a sustainable career and earn a life and be great citizens in New Orleans?
Well, one of the great things about this book is that, well, every now and then, a book will come along that really manages to kind of drill down through every level of society here, because it is so complex. Mm-hmm. And you have this great belief that service workers have a lot to tell us about who we are as a city. And their voices are so strong in this book, and that's obviously so important to you.
It is. I think that most of us are former service workers or have great friends that are service workers.
I've been a waitress.
It's just... None of this could happen without people pouring daiquiris and changing linens. It's wonderful that we have television shows about New Orleans. It's wonderful that people across the world know about us, but we would not function without the young lady who decides to go down to Bourbon Street and go to work every day and risk all the hazards that go along with that. It's often been the first point of entry for people when they move to New Orleans. As you said, you did that. I've done that. People, when they get here, they end up learning about the city by working in kitchens with other New Orleanians, with people from Jefferson Parish and St. Bernard Parish. And they see how people feel about us. Mm-hmm. And they see what people expect of New Orleans. And again, that was really one of my main interests, was to understand how that relationship with the outside world works, how those images are generated for the rest of the world, but just as importantly, from the horse's mouth, what is it like today to work in the French Quarter and to make your living that way and to deal with the changes and the perils and the real prizes of getting to work down there as well? I think there's obviously a freedom to doing it, but I've always believed that we need to speak directly to people that are actually making these things work in order to understand how we can improve them and how we can, as citizens, do a better job.
So what's the take home for you? Was it worth it? Did our bureaucracy serve us well? Have we recovered from that blackout?
My take is that the blackout probably wasn't a lasting negative for us. I think that it's a piece of the puzzle like everything else that happened there. Obviously, after having worked on a book for a year, when the blackout happened, I had somewhat of an epiphany. And as our friend Jarrett Lofsted said to me at the time, well, I guess you have your metaphor.
Because I can just hear him saying that, too.
I think that it's very accurate, though. I think that as much preparations as we can make, something can always happen. And we can't put all our eggs in one basket that way. And there's something mystifying about this city. And no matter how bright the light is, something true about us shines through. I don't think it's that we are mistake-ridden. I just think that odd things happen here. And that's a very odd thing to build an economy around. It's a very difficult thing to depend on sometimes. But to watch that blackout after looking at contrasts and trying to figure out whether things were working or not, it was a poignant moment, to say the least.
Yeah. Well, it's a great picture of life in our city. We've been talking with Brian Boyles, who's the author of New Orleans Boom and Blackout, 100 Days in America's Coolest Hotspot. You can meet Brian Tuesday, January 27th from 6 to 8 at a happy hour release party at Handsome Willie's, 218 South Robertson. He also appears Thursday, January 29th from 6 to 8 for a talk at the Louisiana Humanities Center, 938 Lafayette. Thanks so much, Brian.
Thank you, Susan.
Like his most famous fictional character, Sailor and Lula, writer Barry Gifford has drifted in and out of New Orleans throughout his life, sometimes to write, sometimes to visit, sometimes to live here. He's the author of more than 20 novels, numerous works of nonfiction and poetry, and he'll be here this month to celebrate the final novel in the Sailor and Lula series. The first was adapted for the David Lynch film Wild at Heart in 1990. This final novel concludes the story of these star-crossed lovers with the tale of their son, Pace Roscoe Ripley. The novel is called The Updown. Barry Gifford, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you, Susan. It's nice to talk to you again.
Now, I imagine that your first memories of New Orleans come from spending time here with your father. Isn't that right?
Well, you know, actually, the first memories I have, really, are with my mother when we stayed at the old Roosevelt Hotel, which is Roosevelt again now. It was the Fairmont for some years, of course. And yeah, I was a little boy. Gosh, that was very early 1950s.
And you've spent lots of time here over the years, haven't you?
I have. I mean, I've been in and out of New Orleans, just as you said, and I kept a place there more or less for about 8 years from 1990 to 1998, thanks to Joe DeSalvo and Rosemary James, who owned the Faulkner House books, because I was upstairs there for a long time, and to the generosity of a great many people in New Orleans, and so I still have wonderful friends there.
Now, one of the things I most love that you've written is in The Imagination of the Heart. And there's that wonderful expression of love for New Orleans when Lula comes back here after Katrina to see how the city has fared. So how difficult was that for you to write?
The Imagination of the Heart was the seventh and, again, supposed to be the last in the Sailor and Lula saga. You know, because I didn't write anymore after the first six for 15 years. And then I think it really was Katrina that, and my going back to New Orleans and spending a little time there following the hurricane and the flood, that I really, I suppose I was re-inspired. And I wondered what had happened to Lula after the death of Sailor and their son Pace, who is now, as I invented, working with a construction company to rebuild the city after Katrina. And so I think that I was reinvigorated in that way and eager to see New Orleans reclaim itself, and especially moved by the ghost lands, as I and others, you know, called the upper and lower ninth, and, you know, the devastation that had occurred. And since then, I've been back in New Orleans two or three times.
I love that you've turned your attention to Pace Roscoe Ripley. Tell us what sort of man he's become.
Well, after the death of both of his parents, really what interests Pace, he's had an adventurous life himself, but basically he has not had a real lasting romantic relationship or a sentimental life himself, but he wondered what is at the heart of Sailor and Lula's enduring devotion to one another through all of their lives. And so the conceit at the heart of the Up-Down is that he undertakes to write their story, beginning with Wild at Heart. And so it's really Pace who writes the novel and, you know, writes the saga in an effort to discover himself what their secret was, what lies at the heart of their relationship. And also it's a kind of religious pilgrimage, half-assed at times, and a search for what's called the Up-Down, which is really means the navel or the center, which was a fifth direction in addition to north, south, east, and west that was discussed by Indo-European societies and the Aztecs, among others. And so this piques his interest, and he wants to discover, you know, what is this? And so he's looking for the secret. He's looking for the secret of life, not just the secret that bound his parents together for all their lives.
Because it's Pace, it doesn't seem like a grandiose search. You know what I mean? It seems like a possible search with a possible reward.
Well, it's very personal. So he shuts down his construction business in NO and goes to a number of different places and, strangely enough, winds up in Bay St. Clement, North Carolina, which is his parents' point of origin. Both Sailor and Lula came from North Carolina, and so he winds up having been left by his mother this property in North Carolina, and he goes to live there and determines to sit down and try to discover, as I explained, the secret by writing this story. And, you know, 2,500 pages later, he feels he might be a little bit closer to the truth.
Now, if I were trying to sum up this book for somebody, I would think of it as a real kind of life of a man in full. He's such a rich character. He's so interesting and well-intentioned, even if he doesn't always do the exact right thing. And it's such a wonderful span of time to follow a character. You must have been very sorry to finish this book.
Well, you know, I've said I'm finished with this book three different times, Susan.
Mm.
It's possible that there's something else in the well, but I haven't plumbed it yet. But I don't think so. I think this is it. I mean, he's the last one left. He's the last Ripley standing because he himself, despite having been married and had different relationships, never had any children himself. And in the Up-Down, he ages from 58 to 83.
Yeah.
And so he does live a full life. And, you know, many strange things happen to him in the course of the Up-Down, and he can't get away from it, whether he's just living by himself in North Carolina or traveling through the West or wherever it happens to be. He encounters all these very strange creatures, you know, and he's trying to make some sense of it. He also writes a memoir, and it winds up going into the hands of an old New Orleans girlfriend of his, Marnie Kowalski, who gets it published, and that's the Sailor and Lula saga. So that's Sailor and Lula, the complete novels right there.
Marnie Kowalski is one of the great names, and there are many in your books.
Yeah, she runs a bakery in New Orleans. But it's interesting because recently, not to drop names here, but Nick Cage and I were talking about the possibility. He played Sailor, of course, Lynch's film of Wild at Heart. Then there was another film made from the novels, Perdita Durango with Javier Bardem. And Nick and I were talking recently about making The Up-Down into a film.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is going to be possible yet, but he loved the conceit of his playing the son of Sailor Ripley, the character he played in Wild at Heart. You know, and he says, well, I'm 50 now, I could do it. But just that idea of continuing the line, and I have to say that I'm so thrilled, really, that people, not just in New Orleans or just in the South, but mainly so, I have to say, but people have responded so positively and warmly to the Sailor and Lula novels. And I think that's also an encouraging factor. I think for any writer, you know, in the sense that, you know, you've got a receptive audience out there and that people such as yourself, Susan, you know, are eager to see what happens next.
Well, I would imagine that Laura Dern and Nick Cage are constantly waiting to see what happens, you know?
Well, I don't know about that, but... But there's a slight possibility. I mean, the movie business is not the same in 2015 as it was in 1989 or 90. I mean, it's a whole different thing. The people who go to the movies really want to see, you know, Susan Larsen Conquers the Universe, you know, with a lot of CGI and all of that. This is a pretty down-home story, and it's a very personal story. It's a very New Orleans story, certainly, and in the Up-Down, Pace does come back to visit Marnie Kowalski and stay with her for a while in New Orleans. So I guess for myself, too, there's no getting away from it.
So how has your thinking about New Orleans evolved over time? I mean, it's such a touchstone for you. I always love that. It's like a little present inside every book when you send a character to New Orleans.
Well, it's a mythical place for me. And you are right. I mean, in the beginning, I do remember being with my dad at Two Jacks when I was very little and with my mom at the Roosevelt Hotel. And so it's really embedded in my history. It's there. Even though I wasn't born there, it was in my blood. And I guess that's why I kept returning to it. And also it was one of those places, like San Francisco was, especially in the old days, where you were free to pretty much act the way you wanted to. And, you know, as long as you weren't necessarily harming anybody, at least not in public, you know, you could do what you want. I forget who it was who said to me one time, nobody cares what you're doing in New Orleans. They just want to know who you're doing it with.
Oh, yes, there is that.
It's a small town.
Yes, it is. We've been talking with novelist, poet, screenwriter, we could just say American master, Barry Gifford. You can meet him when he reads from and signs The Up-Down, Tuesday, January 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Barry, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Susan.
Mm-hmm. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Dan Gottman signs Genius Files number 5, License to Thrill, Tuesday, January 27th at 4:30 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Brian Boyles, will be featured at a happy hour release party for New Orleans Boom and Blackout, 100 Days in America's Coolest Hotspot, Tuesday, January 27th from 5 to 8 at Handsome Willie's, 218 South Robertson. Boyles will also discuss Super Bowl IV, the first NFL championship hosted in New Orleans, Thursday, January 29th, from 6 to 8 at the Louisiana Humanities Center, 938 Lafayette Street. Today's guest, novelist Barry Gifford, signs The Up Down, Tuesday, January 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Travel writer Paul Oswell discusses his new book, New Orleans Historic Hotels, Tuesday, January 27th at 7 at East Bank Regional Library. Ronald Drez, author of The War of 1812, Conflict and Deception, and Morgan McCall Mothrop, author of Andrew Jackson's Playbook, 15 Strategies for Success, discuss and sign their books Wednesday, January 28th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Elizabeth Annie Peterson, preservation librarian of the Howard Tilton Memorial Library at Tulane, will discuss proper preservation techniques of personal documents Wednesday, January 28th at 7 at the West Bank Regional Library in Harvey. Carolyn Brown discusses her two biographies, A Daring Life, a biography of Eudora Welty, and Song of My Life, a biography of Margaret Walker, Thursday, January 29th from noon to 2 at the Madisonville Branch Library at 1123 Main Street. Judy Fraden discusses and signs her book for young adults, Stolen into Slavery, The True Story of Solomon Northup, Free Black Man, Thursday, January 29th at 4:30 at Octavia Books. The East Jefferson Fiction Writers Group meets Thursday, January 29th at 6:30 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Rosary Hartel O'Neill signs her novel, Degas in New Orleans, Thursday, January 29th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses Tolstoy and the Purple Chair by Nina Sankovich, Tuesday, February 3rd at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop. Anya Kamenet signs The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, Tuesday, February 3rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Tom Cooper signs The Marauders, Tuesday, February 3rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Jamie Attenberg, author of The Middlesteins, The Kept Man, The Melting Season, and Instant Love, is the featured reader at the 1718 Reading Series, Tuesday, February 3rd at 7 at the Collins Hotel. Nancy Dixon discusses and signs N.O. Lit, 200 Years of New Orleans Literature, Tuesday, February 3rd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And, inspired by the old game show Supermarket Sweep, friends of the New Orleans Public Library will be having a shopping cart contest of their own. How would you like to run wild through the Friends' basement, grab all the books, CDs, and records you can fit in a shopping cart in 2 minutes, and it won't cost you a dime? They're even going to play goofy music and cheer for you. Dust off those tennis shoes and like the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library Facebook page and tag friends in the Supermarket Sweep post at the top to officially enter. A random winner will be selected and announced on March 15th. And just a reminder, the Friends hold a book sale in the Carriage House behind Ladder Memorial Library every Wednesday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Donations of books, CDs, DVDs, and albums are always welcome. These items can be brought to the library basement at 5120 St. Charles Avenue when the sale is open. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.